Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man, 23, Creed of the Mountain Man, narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Tim Getman, Drew Copeland, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael John Casey, Thomas Keegan, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, Lynette Savard, David Korn, Thomas Penny, Christopher Shear, Terrence Azar, Andy Clemens, James Konacek, Joe Brack, Stephen Carpenter, Ken Jackson, Johann Detweiler, and Michael Glenn.
Smoke Jensen and Pearly were leaning on a corral fence, watching a cow try to break one of the horses Smoke had bought for the Sugarloaf removal.
Ride him, cowboy! Don't let that coyote show you who's boss!
The boy, in his late teens, was holding on to the hurricane deck for dear life. Smoke smiled and tilted his hat back.
I know Cal is pretty good with most horses, but I think this one has his number.
Just then, the horse bent almost double and gave a quick double jump and twisted sideways at the same time. Cow went flying head over heels to land in a pile of horse apples in the middle of the corral.
He's forked end up, Smoke.
Cow climbed shakily to his feet and made his way over to the fence.
Jiminy Christmas, Smoke. That there broomtail acts like he got a burr under his saddle. You didn't do something nasty like that to me, did you, Pearly?
No, Cal. I didn't put no sticker under your saddle. I didn't figure I needed to since there weren't no way you was going to be able to stay in the saddle nohow.
What do you mean, Pearly? You think I can't break that horse? Just give me another try. We'll see.
Hold on, Cal. We all know you're a pretty good rider. But breaking horses takes some specialized knowledge. Pearly. Show him how it's done.
Pearly pulled his hat down tight and walked to the snorting horse, ignoring the way it was pawing the ground and looking wall-eyed. He bent down and picked up the reins, bringing the horse's head down toward his face. He grabbed its ears, bent it over, and swung into the saddle. As the mount kicked up its heels, Pearly threw his weight forward, wrapped his arms around its neck, and squeezed and twisted the animal's ear almost double. Pearly dug his spurs in and made the bronc trot around the corral a time or two. After a few minutes, he let go of the horse's ear and continued to ride in peace. The horse trotting as if wearing a saddle and rider was the most natural thing in the world. Pearly grinned and took his hat off and swept it in front of him as he took a bow toward Cal while riding the now docile animal.
Well, I'll be gosh darned.
That's an old-timer's trick, Cal. The old trail hands used to tell the tenderfeet that they were whispering in the horse's ear when they did that, but they were really just putting all their weight on the animal's neck and using the ear to cause it enough pain to make it forget all about the bucking. It doesn't always work that well, but you had already tired the animal out enough that he was about ready to quit bucking anyway. Of course, Pearly's going to try to take all the credit for it. You just watch.
Pearly trotted his mount over to the two men.
See, cowboy? It's easy when you're an old hand at breaking horses like I am.
That's bull and you know it, Pearly. I already had that crazy animal plumb tuckered out so he couldn't hardly walk, much less buck you off.
Okay, boys, that's enough jawing. Let's get the rest of this sorry bunch of animals broken so we can get some lunch.
Yes, sir.
Pearly walked his bronc over to the gate and put it in with the ones already broken. He and Cal managed to saddle another of the wild horses, and he walked back over to the stand next to Smoke as Cal once again tried his hand. The young man leaned forward on the horse's neck this time and twisted its ear.
Smoke, I can't hardly believe the changes to Cal since Miss Sally brought him back to the ranch a few years ago.
Neither can I, Pearlie.
As Smoke grinned at his memory of the day Cal arrived, his thought turned to his foreman, Pearlie, standing next to him. Pearlie had come to work for Smoke in as roundabout a way as Cal had. He was hiring his gun out to Tilden Franklin in Fontana when Franklin went crazy and tried to take over Sugarloaf. Smoke and Sally spread. After Franklin's men raped and killed a young girl in the fracas, Pearlie sided with Smoke and the aging gunfighters he had called in to help put an end to Franklin's reign of terror. Pearlie was now honorary foreman of Smoke's ranch, though he was only a shade over 24 years old himself. Boys grew to be men early in the mountains of Colorado. Sally, Smoke's pretty wife, appeared next to him, breaking his reverie.
Howdy, boys. I thought you might like to take a little break and have a snack before lunch.
Sally was carrying a platter of still steaming bear sign, the sweet donuts that cowboys have been known to ride 10 miles for.
Woo! Hey, Cal, Miss Sally's got some bear sign for us.
As Cal looked over, he let his concentration slip and he released the horse's ear. The boy sprang to his feet, slapped that bucking horse out of his way with his hat, and ran to jump over the fence.
Oh. Boy, howdy! I could sure use some nourishment, Miss Sally.
Sally handed the platter of donuts to Pearlie and a pitcher of lemonade and some glasses to Smoke. She shook her head and started back toward the cabin.
You boys don't work Smoke too hard breaking those broom tails. He's getting on up in years and may not be able to take it.
Dear, you notice I'm not the one sweating here. It's these two young bucks who are doing all the work. I'm busy supervising.
Good. Then that means they can have all the bear sign.
Like hell.
The day finally over, Smoke and Sally sat at the kitchen table, having a cup of after-dinner coffee.
Sweetheart, I'm going to make a trip to Wyoming.
Why?
Seven, the Palouse stud Preacher gave me, is getting old. And even though he's bred us some good crosses for our Remuda, they aren't Palouses. I want to find some more Palouse stock mares and maybe another stud or two to carry on Seven's line.
Smoke didn't have to say any more for Sally to understand this was his way of keeping alive the memory of the man who meant as much to him as his own father. Back when Smoke's name was Kirby Jensen, just after the end of the Civil War, he and his father came west from their crabapple farm in Missouri with all they had strapped to one mule. Soon, they met Preacher, an old mountain man who saved their lives from a band of marauding Indians. During the fight, young Kirby killed his share of the attackers, and he was given the name Smoke by Preacher, both for the thin trail of smoke from his Colt Navy 36, as well as for the color of his ash blonde hair. After traveling with the mountain man for a spell, Smoke's father was killed by three men who had stolen gold from the Confederate Army. Preacher took Smoke in and raised him for the next several years, teaching him all the lore of the strange breed known as mountain men.
What about horse?
Sally was referring to the Palouse Smoke had been riding since putting Seven in his own pasture on the Sugarloaf to run free and enjoy his old age.
I'd like to carry on his line, too. I ran across a trapper coming down from the mountains for supplies last week. He said the Nez Perce tribe that used to live there was gone. He didn't know where, but he'd heard there was still a small band of them camped up near Buffalo in northern Wyoming. The Nez Perce are the ones who developed the Palouse breed, Sally, and they always keep a good supply of breeding mares and studs on hand. I plan to go to Wyoming before the tribe gets killed off, or mixes with another and loses their identity. I'm going to carry on the Palouse line here on the Sugarloaf, starting with Seven and horse.
But Smoke, it's the middle of winter. Don't you think this will wait until spring, at least?
No, I don't want to be gone during the spring calving and branding. That's too heavy a load to leave on Pearlie and Cal. I'm going to get on the Union Pacific Line train and take it all the way to Casper, a little range town at the foot of the Bighorn Mountains. From there, I'll pack by horse up into the mountain north of Buffalo and see if I can find out where the Nez Perce are now. Then it's just a matter of doing some good old-fashioned horse trading.
I don't like the idea of your traveling halfway across the country in the dead of winter by yourself. Why don't you take Cal or Pearlie with you?
There's too much work here they need to be doing. Fences need mending, corrals have to be built, and the cattle have got to be taken care of. Besides, do you think this old beaver is getting too old to make a trip by himself? You think I need taking care of?
Sally stared at Smoke for a moment without speaking, as if she was considering just that possibility. Finally, she got up from the table, took her apron off, and began to walk toward their bedroom.
Oh, I don't think you're getting old at all. But why don't you come to bed and show me just how young you're feeling?
Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hubert Teschmacher and Frederick O. DeBillier swung their identical gold-headed walking sticks to and fro as they approached the Cheyenne Club through a light snowfall. They swaggered as they walked, tipping their top hats at other prominent citizens as they passed. Having come to Wyoming from Boston a few years back with $500,000 to invest, they were well aware of their place in Cheyenne society as two of the wealthiest men in the state capital.
Freddy, we've come a long way since we roomed together at Harvard.
Yes, Hubert. This western country is certainly different from Boston, wouldn't you say?
Yes, of course. There is no culture at all out here. And the food is generally atrocious, but then there is always the Cheyenne Club to relieve our boredom.
DeBillier smiled back, adjusting his silk cravat as the two men entered the three-story Cheyenne Club, described in its charter as a pleasure resort and place of amusement. A doorman in formal attire took their overcoats and hats and walking sticks.
Good evening, sirs. The others in your party are awaiting you on the third floor.
The first floor of the Cheyenne Club was the kitchen and storage area for the vast supplies of liquor and wine and other culinary delicacies the members maintained. The second floor was the communal room, where the prettiest whores in the state would arrange themselves in various small cubicles and rooms to play pianos or other musical instruments, to sing and otherwise amuse their wealthy clients. All of the girls were hand-picked by Teschmacher and DeBillier, who as co-founders of the Cheyenne Club retained certain perks for themselves. The third floor was the dining and meeting hall. Dozens of overstuffed leather chairs and tables were arranged around the room in the manner of the English men's clubs that Teschmacher and DeBillier had seen on their travels abroad. In a separate room was a dining table made of carved oak over 20 feet long, with chairs to seat 40 diners. Butlers and maids were everywhere, and the floors were connected to the kitchen by a series of dumbwaiters, so the members were never without food or drink for very long. Hubert and Frederick climbed the stairs.
Now remember, Freddy, we must handle Hess with extreme care in our discussion tonight.
I know, Hubie. That damned pompous, limey bastard won't agree to anything unless he's made to feel it's his idea.
Exactly. So the trick is to simply lead him in the right direction so that he'll decide things our way.
What about Bill Irving?
Oh, William is just a mid-level manager for his investors back in Omaha. He'll do whatever we tell him to do, since it's his butt on the line if the ranch doesn't make a profit every year.
They finally reached the third floor and walked into the anteroom, where they saw their friends standing in small groups with Cuban cigars in their hands and crystal goblets filled with brandy and Kentucky bourbon. Teschmacher and DeBillier had spared no expense in decorating the room, making use of a French decorator brought over for just that reason. There were paintings on every wall and a 25-foot gilded mirror behind a massive, ornately carved mahogany bar that ran the length of the room, stocked with thousands of dollars worth of expensive whiskeys and wines and brandies. A billiard table was in a corner, underneath a fancy French chandelier with hundreds of small candles arrayed around the crystal glass it was made of. The polished wooden floors were covered with hand-woven rugs of the finest wool. Hubert and Frederick had invited a group of the richest and most influential men in the county to attend the meeting, all owners or managers of the largest cattle ranches in the area. William Irving managed a large ranch owned by millionaire backers from Omaha and served as a director of the Cheyenne and Northern Railroad and other corporations. Fred Hess, an Englishman, had worked, swindled, Hubert often said, his way up from foreman to manager of a ranching system that grazed tens of thousands of cattle on far-flung Wyoming ranges. Major Frank Walcott was a former Army officer from Kentucky who still wore puttees and maintained his military bearing despite a twisted neck, acquired in a tussle with a Laramie cowboy. That twist left his head permanently cocked to one side. Most of the plutocrats in the group had spent less time in the saddle than in the state capitol, spending most of their nights in the plush and exclusive surroundings of the Cheyenne Club. Tonight, there were 41 members attending the club banquet arranged by Hubert and Frederick. Some were playing billiards, while others nibbled at pickled eels and French hors d'oeuvres while waiting for dinner to be sent up. Hubert had ordered 20 bottles of wine and over 60 bottles of champagne for his guests tonight. There would be none left by night's end. After greeting each of the cattle barons, Hubert signaled the head butler that dinner was to be served. Later, as the men sat around with more brandy and cigars, Hubert addressed them from his station at the head of the table.
Gentlemen, we are at a crossroads here in Wyoming. As you know, the small ranches in the area are getting more and more brazen about stealing and rustling our cattle. We are suffering unacceptable losses to our herds from the depredations of these thieves, and some drastic measures may have to be undertaken.
Even as he spoke, Hubert knew that most of the losses of the big ranchers were due to poor management practices, such as overstocking the range, unpredictable whims of nature in the form of prairie fires and plagues of feed-destroying grasshoppers and sieges of bad weather. But he also knew that whenever lean dividends had to be explained to far-off investors, rustlers provided the best excuse. William Irving moved to speak.
But Hubert, what about our cowboy blacklist, where we agreed not to hire cowboys who own their own spreads and cattle? Isn't that working?
No. In fact, our scheme has actually backfired on us and has driven many of these cowboys who can't find work with us to strike out on their own with small ranches that further eat into our profits.
Fred Hess stood, and he adjusted his vest before speaking.
How about the law we arranged to be passed by the legislature, the Maverick Law, making every unbranded stray calf on the range the property of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association, which we control? In my annual report, I see that we are making huge profits on the cattle that we auction off under the law.
Yes, we are making a profit. But most of that is being spent to hire stock detectives and pay them $250 for every rustler convicted or killed. Furthermore, the small ranchers are calling these detectives bounty hunters and assassins, and are making a lot of noise in the legislature to get the Maverick Law repealed.
Hubert pointed down the table at Albert Bothwell, one of the wealthiest and most arrogant of the cattle barons present.
And it didn't help matters any when Al lynched those two homesteaders on the Sweetwater Range last summer.
Bothwell stood up, his face red and flushed from several bottles of wine.
Damn it, Hubie. You know Jim Avril and Ella Watson were squatting on my land illegally, and that whore Watson was known to take her pay in cattle, rustled off my range.
I know, Al. That's why we spread the rumor in the newspapers that her name was Cattle Kate and that she was a gun-toting rustler queen. But it's harder to explain to people how Jim Avril, who owned not a single cow, was a rustler.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. He deserved to die for trying to settle on my land.
All right, Al. But what I'm trying to say is that all these things have not served to stop the rustling. I want to propose something a bit more severe.
I'm sure for anything that'll stop those damn rustlers from stealing me out of house and home. And now they've had the effrontery to form their own association, calling it the Northern Wyoming Farmers and Stock Growers Association. Hell, I think it's just a fancy name for a den of thieves and footpads and rustlers to hide behind.
Gentlemen, what I propose is to completely wipe out that organization and exterminate the rustlers once and for all.
William Irving stared at Hubert thoughtfully.
Well, just how do you plan to do that, Hubie? especially since Sheriff Red Angus in Buffalo, up where most of the rustlers operate, is openly sympathetic to the small ranchers.
First, we must recruit a force of gunfighters from outside the state and send them in force against Johnson County, which is the headquarters of the rustlers. Home to men like Nate Champion, who is the head of the Northern Wyoming Farmers and Stock Growers Association. Then, we cut all telegraph wires that link the county to the rest of the state, thus isolating the citizens while our attacks get underway. Next, we take over the town of Buffalo, which is the county seat, and assassinate the sheriff, his deputies, and the three county commissioners, thereby stripping the county of its leadership. And finally, we dispose of all the men on this death list I've got here that our WSGA detectives have put together.
Hubert held up a fistful of papers with over 70 names printed on them. At first, as the idea sank in, there was stunned silence from the men sitting before Hubert. It wasn't the fact that they'd be breaking the law. Hell, they did that most every day. It was the sheer magnitude of the thing that gave them pause. None of the others had thought on such a grand scale before. Hubert knew he had them. He sat down and leaned back. After a moment, Mike Shonesy, a local rancher who was talking quietly to Charlie Ford, foreman of the TA ranch, looked up.
Hubie, your idea sounds good on the surface, but just who do you have in mind to lead this expedition against the Johnson County rustlers? And where are you going to find enough gunfighters to carry out your plan?
Hubert stood up and signaled the head waiter to his side, whispering in his ear. The man left the room and returned a few minutes later with two men in tow. They walked over to stand at the head of the table next to Hubert Teschmacher. Hubert put his hand on the first man's shoulder. He stood a couple of inches over 6 feet tall, had a wide mustache curled around the corners of his mouth, and he wore a grim, serious expression.
I'm sure most of you know Frank Canton, former sheriff of Johnson County and now one of WSGA's best stock detectives.
Several of the men at the table nodded and smiled at Canton, knowing him to be a stone killer who had already murdered several rustlers in his duties for the association. Hubert pointed to the other man, somewhat shorter than Canton, also sporting a dark mustache. He was broader, with a stocky body, and wearing a black coat with twin Colt 45s strapped to his belt.
This is Tom Smith, another of our fine stock detectives, ex-deputy U.S. Marshal from Texas, who is going to lead our recruiting drive by going back to his old stomping grounds and finding us some of the toughest men in the country to help us with a war against the rustlers in Johnson County.
Tom, just how are you going to convince these men to come all the way up here in the dead of winter to fight our war for us?
Smith stepped to the head of the table, a small smile on his face.
I'm going to offer them wages of $5 a day, a bonus of $50 to every man for each rustler killed, no matter who kills him, and a $3,000 accident policy for each volunteer. I figure I'll need between 20 and 30 hard cases to get the job done.
Jesus, that's going to come to a lot of money, Hubie.
Well, that's right. And I'm going to ask each member of the WSGA to donate $1,000 to the war fund. With over 100 members, that'll be more than enough to get the men and equipment we need. Bill, I'm going to need the cooperation of the Cheyenne and Northern Railroad to send Tom and Frank down to Texas and to bring the Texicans back up here. There's no other way to get them here with the weather so bad right now, and we need to get this done before the spring calving, or we're going to lose a lot more herd to the rustlers.
Well, that'll be no problem. I'll arrange for a couple of cars to be added to the southern run. But what about horses and weapons for the gunmen?
I plan to send a couple of our men over to Colorado and to buy what we need there. If we try to round up that many extra mounts from local ranches, it would raise too many questions, and the rustlers might get wind of our plans. I've already arranged to buy 3 heavy freight wagons, and I've placed orders for tents, bedding, guns, pistols, and ammunition enough to see us through this war.
Hubert waved the men toward the parlor.
Now, if any of you have any further questions, Tom and Frank will be glad to answer them over coffee and cigars.
Cal and Pearlie accompanied Smoke into Big Rock, the town he had founded a few years back after the Tilden Franklin affair. He had packed his buckskins and moccasins and most of his guns in a large valise, and he was wearing his traveling clothes, a flannel shirt, corduroy pants tucked into knee-high leather boots, and a rawhide coat with fur on the inside to protect against a harsh winter of northern Wyoming. His only weapons were a Colt Navy 36 carried in a shoulder holster under the coat, and a bowie knife and a scabbard on his belt.
Smoke, I sure wish you'd let one of us go with you.
Nah, don't start on me, Pearly. I've already hashed this out with Sally. I don't need you trying to play nursemaid to me, too.
How are you planning on getting those horses back here, Smoke? You can't hardly drive them here by yourself over those mountain passes in the winter.
I'm not going to drive them here at all, Cal. I'm going to hire a special boxcar on the train and ship them by rail.
Yeah, Smoke, it's just not going to be the same around here without you.
Pearly, I need someone I can trust to look after the Sugarloaf and to make sure Sally's all right. I'm depending on you and Cal to keep things going until I get back.
You can count on us. At least I'll try not to let Pearly eat you out of house and home before you get back.
Well, look at who's coming down the road. Is that some eastern dude? Perhaps a tenderfoot has lost his way?
Monty Carson, the sheriff in Big Rock, was leaning against the door jamb of his office, a cigar in one hand and a steaming tin of coffee in the other. Smoke and Monty Carson had become very good friends over the past few years. Carson had once been a well-known gunfighter, although he had never ridden the Owl Hoot Trail. A local rancher with plans to take over the county and hired Carson to be the law in Fontana, a town just down the road from Smoke Sugarloaf spread. Carson went along with the man's plans for a while till he couldn't stomach the rapings and killings any longer. He put his foot down and let it be known that Fontana was going to be run in a law-abiding manner from then on. The rancher, Tilden Franklin, sent a bunch of riders in to teach the upstart lawman a lesson. The men killed Carson's two deputies and seriously wounded him, taking over the town. In retaliation, Smoke founded the town of Big Rock, and he and a band of famous aging gunfighters cleaned house in Fontana. When the fracas was over, Smoke offered the job of sheriff in Big Rock to Monty Carson. He married a grass widow and settled into the job like he was born to it. Neither Smoke nor the citizens of Big Rock ever had cause to regret his taking the job.
You know, there's men planted all over this country for talking to me like that, cowboy. You looking for trouble?
Oh, no sir, Mr. Gunfighter, sir. I just didn't recognize the famous gunhawk Smoke Jensen in those fancy city duds. I apologize if I offended your delicate sensibilities, sir.
I'll forgive you if you got some more of that coffee cooking on the stove in your office.
Come on in. Light and sit and talk a while, Smoke. Been too long since we've had a palaver.
Smoke got down off horse.
Pearly, Cal, why don't you two go over to Lewis's saloon and have yourself some breakfast while I talk with Monty.
Pearly didn't even answer. He just spurred his mount and galloped off in a cloud of dust.
You know, you have to be careful when you ask Pearly if any of you wants food, Smoke, or you'll be liable to get trampled in the stampede.
Smoke stepped into the sheriff's office and poured himself a cup of coffee.
Oh, damn, Monty. This stuff is thick enough to float a horseshoe.
Hell, Smoke, nobody's forcing you to drink it, and you sure can't argue about the price.
The two men sat on opposite sides of Carson's desk, and Smoke began to tell his friend about his plans to travel to Wyoming in search of suitable horse flesh to replenish his remuda. After he caught up on all the news about his friends in town, Smoke stood and stretched.
How'd you like some breakfast over at Longmont's? It's on me.
You don't have to ask me twice, Smoke. Let's see if we can get Lewis's fancy chef Andre to cook up some regular food for a change. None of them frog legs or whatever.
As they walked down the street toward the saloon, suddenly Cal came flying backwards out of the bat wings, landing sprawled on his back with blood streaming from his nose.
Cal, can you hear me? Are you all right?
Oh, I guess so. Jiminy, but that fellow packs a mean punch.
Seems like every time I bring you to town, Cal, you end up bleeding on me. Well, at least this time you haven't been shot.
Pearly was standing next to a table, twin Colts in his hands, pointed at two large men with heavy beards dressed in dirty buckskins. He glanced over his shoulder at Smoke.
Is Cal all right?
Yeah. What happened here?
These two galoots were talking bad about you, Smoke. They were saying they heard you got your reputation by being a back-shooting coward. Cal told them to take it back, and they walloped him without any warning whatsoever.
Smoke glanced over to an adjacent table where Louis Longmont sat, smoking a cigar and drinking brandy out of a large crystal snifter. The gambler had a slight smile on his face, but Smoke noticed the rawhide thong was off his colt and his right hand was lying on his thigh, indicating Louis was ready to step in if Pearly needed any help.
That's about the size of it, Louis.
Yes. Pearly has reported the events that transpired with amazing clarity and accuracy. These gentlemen were being very disparaging of you, Smoke, and I was on the verge of asking them to depart when Cal took them to task for their remarks.
Smoke frowned as he took a pair of black gloves, padded over the knuckles out of the back of his belt, and walked toward the two trappers.
Hey, you assholes have something to say about me? You can say it to my face instead of picking on someone half your size.
We got a right to our opinion, Jensen. We was just saying what we heard, that's all. Ain't that right, Exa?
Jess is right. It's just a friendly little fracas. We're no need to get pistols involved.
No such thing as a friendly fight, mister. Fighting is deadly serious, especially when your opponent is only a boy.
Well, he shouldn't ought to call me a liar. I don't let nobody, boy nor man, talk to me like that.
Oh, is that so? Well, I don't only think you're a liar, but I think you stink. I could smell your rotten carcass from across the street.
You wouldn't dare talk to me like that if you didn't have no six-shooter back in your play.
Pearly, holster your weapons. I'm gonna teach this ignorant bastard a lesson in manners.
Jesse grinned and suddenly swung a meaty fist in a roundhouse right cross at Smoke's head, trying to surprise him. The mountain man ducked easily under the punch and stabbed a quick right jab square into the man's nose and a left hook square into the man's temple.
I'm gonna kill you, Jensen.
I don't think so.
Smoke bent, took a gold double eagle coin from the trapper's poke and handed it to Louis.
They should pay for their drinks and any damage they caused.
Indeed it shall, Smoke. Indeed it shall.
Smoke looked up as Cal stumbled in, holding a bandana to his face.
Where are they? I want another shot of that big bastard.
You're just a tad late, son. Smoke's already taken care of that for you.
Smoke put his arm around Cal's shoulder and led him to a table.
Come on, Cal. Let's have that breakfast you came here for.
Andre, fresh coffee and buns for our guests. Then burn five steaks and scramble some hen's eggs with chopped tomatoes and onions. These men look hungry.
As Cal and Pearly and Monte Carson sat at their table, Smoke walked over to shake Lewis's hand.
Thanks for the backup, partner. I appreciate it.
You noticed?
Even if I hadn't, I always know you've got my back, compadre.
Lewis nodded and raised his brandy glass in a salute to his friend of many years. The gambler owned this saloon and considered it his home. It was where he plied his trade, which he called teaching amateurs the laws of chance. Lewis was a lean, hawk-faced man with strong, slender hands and long fingers, nails carefully manicured and the hands clean. He had jet black hair and a black pencil-thin mustache. He was, as usual, dressed in a black suit with white shirt and dark ascot, something he'd picked up on a trip to England some years back. He wore low-heeled boots and a pistol hung in tied-down leather on his right side. It was not for show, for Lewis was snake-quick with a short gun, and he was a feared, deadly gun hand when pushed. Now, Lewis was not an evil man. He had never hired his gun out for money. And while he could make a deck of cards do almost anything, he did not cheat at poker. Hell, he didn't have to cheat. He was possessed of a phenomenal memory. He could tell you the odds of filling any type of poker hand and was one of the first to use the new method of card counting. He was just past 40 years of age. He had come to the West as a boy, arriving with his parents from Louisiana. His parents had died in a shantytown fire, leaving the boy to cope as best he could. He'd coped pretty damn well, applying his innate intelligence and willingness to take a chance into a fortune. He owned a large ranch up in Wyoming Territory, several businesses in San Francisco, and a hefty chunk of a railroad. Though it was a mystery to many why Longmont stayed with the hard life he had chosen, Smoke thought he understood. Once, Lewis had said to him,
"Smoke, I would miss my life every bit as much as you would miss the dry-mouthed moment before the draw. The challenge of facing and besting those miscreants who would kill you or others, and the so-called loneliness of the Owl Hoot Trail."
Smoke tipped his hat and went back to join his friends at their table, where Pearlie was telling Cal how Smoke had whipped the two trappers. Nate Champion tugged gently at the reins of his big dun stallion and stopped in the shade of a copse of pinyon trees. He pulled a pair of battered binoculars out of his saddlebags and began to look over the herd of milling cattle spread out in the valley below him. Sure enough, he didn't have to search for very long before he found what he was looking for. There, mixed in with the other cattle, were over 50 of Nate's own beeves. He put the binoculars back in his saddlebag, pulled out his old Winchester Model 1873, and levered around into the chamber. He shoved the carbine in the saddle boot, and then flipped open the loading gate on his Colt Army and checked his loads. He knew Shonesy was going to be plenty pissed when he braced him about the cattle, and he wanted to be ready for anything. Nearing 20 years of age, Nate Champion had been born in Round Rock, Texas, and was considered a top cowboy by all who knew him. With a fierce mustache, he was a solid, good-looking man, noted for his honesty and forthrightness. He had many friends among the punchers and small ranchers in northern Wyoming. Until he was blacklisted 6 months ago by the Wyoming Stock Growers Association, starting his own small herd, he'd been the kind of cowboy every ranch owner wanted. Now that he was persona non grata to the big ranchers of the association, it was a different story. Nate was not a man they could scare. He was handy with a gun and never far from his weapons. He didn't plan to back down from Shonesy, or any of the other cattle barons for that matter, no matter how many hired guns they had riding for their brand. Nate slipped his Colt in his holster, but left the rawhide hammer thong off, and rode down the slope of the hill toward the group of men tending Shonesy's herd below. Johnny Garfield was the first of the men to notice Nate Champion riding over. He settled back against the cantle of his saddle and waited to see what Champion had to say.
Howdy, Nate. What are you doing over here?
I thought your spray was about 10 miles the other side of the creek over there.
Well, Johnny, it's true, my spread's over to the east, but damned if about a fourth of my beeves aren't right here with yours.
You don't say. Huh. Now that you mention it, I did see some beeves that didn't look familiar to me this morning. I just put it down to some mavericks having drifted into the herd during the night.
Yeah, Johnny, except mavericks don't generally have brands on them, and these do. My brand.
I can see that, Nate, now that you pointed out.
I better ride on in there and cut my cattle out of yours, and then I'll drive them back to my place.
I don't know, Nate. Ever since you've been blacklisted by the association, Mr. Shonesy been talking bad about you something fierce. Matter of fact, he's kind of spreading the word that you were blacklisted for rustling cattle.
That's so?
Yeah. He said that's how you managed to put your herd together, by taking mavericks off the range that belong to the association and putting your brand on.
Johnny, how long you been punching cows here in Wyoming?
About 5 years. Why?
And you know that most of the land around here is owned by the government. And mavericks have always belonged to whoever took the trouble to round them up and brand them. It's because the Stock Growers Association bribed the legislature to write a nonsense law saying they belong to the association don't make it so.
Well, that may be, Nate, but it's still the law. Mr. Shonesy says that sash you're wearing is the mark of your gang of rustlers. Even says it's called the Red Sash Gang.
Nate, who was something of a dude in his dress, was wearing black corduroy pants, a red and black checkered flannel shirt, and a red sash tied around his waist.
Now I've heard everything. Hell, half the cowboys I know wear these things, Johnny. They get them from the Sears and Roebuck catalog and wear them because the ladies seem to like them.
Well, anyways, Mr. Shonesy won't like it much if I let you cut some bees out of his herd. I'll tell you what, Nate. We're going to be moving this herd tomorrow, and I'll have the boys cut any bees with the KC brand on them out and leave them here for you. How's that?
I'll take your word on it, Johnny. I'll be back just after dawn with a few of my men to pick them up.
The next morning, Mike Shonesy was out on the range with his men when Garfield and the others culled Champion's beeves from his herd. After Garfield and the other drovers drove Shonesy's cattle over the hill toward another range to feed, Shonesy turned to the two men with him.
Bob, I want you and Curly to scatter those cattle all over the range.
Bob Cartwright looked at his boss in pure disbelief.
But, Mr. Shonesy, those are Nate Champion's cattle. If we do that, it'll take him 2 days to round them up.
Bob, I don't recall asking your advice on the matter. I'm foreman of this spread, and as long as you ride for this brand, you'll do what I say. Is that clear?
Yes, sir, Mr. Shonesy.
Cartwright yanked his hat down tight, pulled his pistol out, and put the spurs to his mount. He and Curly charged toward the small group of cattle. Grazing cattle stampeded off in several directions. 10 minutes later, Shonesy and Bob and Curly were riding toward Shonesy's herd. Nate Champion came riding after him, leaning over his saddle and raising a cloud of dust. Shonesy pulled his mount to a stop and waited.
All right, boys, here he comes. And he looks madder than a wet hen.
Why'd you scatter my beeves, Shonesy?
Because they were grazing on my land, eating feed that belongs to my cattle, that's why.
This ain't your land, asshole. This is free range, in case you've forgotten, and it's open to anybody's cattle that wants to use it.
Well, Champion, seeing as how there's three of us and only one of you, just what do you intend to do about it?
Nate cut his eyes to the two men with Shonesy. He straightened in his saddle and let his hand hang near his colt.
You boys want some of this?
Bob and Curly looked at each other, then looked at Shonesy, their eyes wide. They both knew Champion's reputation as a fast gun.
We ride for Mr. Shonesy, Nate, but he don't pay us for no gunplay. This between you and him.
Looks like it's you and me, Mike. You want to make your play?
Now, wait a minute, Champion. I don't intend to draw on you. You can't shoot a man down in cold blood over a few head of cattle.
No, you're right, Mike. I can't shoot a coward who won't back his play.
Nate swung out of the saddle and walked over to stand before the man on the ground.
Get up, you spineless cow flop.
I'm not going to fight you, Champion.
Nate, who stood a couple of inches over 6 feet and had broad shoulders and wiry muscles from years riding the range, reached down and grabbed Shonesy by the front of his shirt, lifting the man to his feet as if he were a child. Shonesy swung a wild punch at Nate's head. Nate ducked the blow, twisted his shoulder to the side, and swung with all his might.
Take his piece of crap back to his ranch and get him doctored up. Spread the word that the next time any of your men touch or mess with any of my beeves, I'll kill them. If any of your men have a problem with that, you know where to find me.
You know, Curly, I think I may just mosey on down south to see if there's any work down there. Mr. Shonesy don't pay me enough for this. That Champion's meaner than a two-peckered billy goat, and I don't want to be on the receiving end of that fist of his. And unless I miss my guess, things around here are gonna get a whole lot worse before they get better.
Nate Champion pulled his dun horse to a halt on a ridge overlooking a wide, flat range that stretched as far as the eye could see. He nodded at his friend, George Flatnose Curry, sitting on a horse next to him.
George, See those beeves down there?
Yep.
Those are the cattle Bob Tilsdale stole from my herd the other day.
Let me get this straight, Nate. Tilsdale put 2,000 cattle onto a range where you was already grazing your herd, then had the balls when you braced him about it to drive his cattle and yours over this range?
That's about the size of it.
Well, that some bitch is too dumb to know who he's messing with, ain't he?
Tell me, George, what would your old pals in the Wild Bunch or the Hole in the Wall gang do about something like that?
Curry, who wore two pistols on his belt, butt first for cross-handed draws, and a double bandolier of Winchester rifle shells across his chest, pulled his rifle out of its saddle boot and levered a shell into the chamber.
Yeah, they'd probably do what we're gonna do in a few minutes.
Nate glanced back over his shoulder at the 12 hard cases riding with him and Curry.
Load them up 6 and 6, boys.
A few minutes later, the 14 men put the spurs to their horses and charged down the hill in a cloud of dust toward the cattle milling below. Robert Tilsdale's men minding the herd looked up and saw him coming. Joshua Barlow, Tilsdale's foreman, almost swallowed his chewing tobacco when he saw the group of heavily armed men riding down on him.
Rustlers coming! Draw your guns, boys!
The other 6 men riding herd glanced at each other, then pulled the reins around and headed their horses away from the fracas, wanting no part of gunplay to save a few cattle that didn't even belong to them. Barlow, seeing as he was standing alone against the men, held up his hands as Nate and his group approached.
Howdy, Nate.
Howdy, Josh.
Nate holstered his pistol and signaled his men to put their guns away.
You boys doing way out here this morning?
Come to get my beeves, Josh.
The ones your boss stole from Nate the other day.
We didn't mean to take your cattle, Nate. But Mr. Tilsdale wouldn't give us time to cut them out of the herd. He said to drive them all over here, and he'd make sure you got yours back later.
That's bullshit, and you know it, Josh. You know as well as I do, he never intended to give me my cattle back.
Hey, Nate, I'm just a hired hand doing what I'm told. I don't ever mix in politics nor other people's business.
Good. Then you can just ride on over to that stand of trees over yonder and sit your butt down. Take a little siesta while we get Nate's beeves.
Barlow hesitated just a moment, as if weighing his chances against Curry, before he nodded and jerked his horse's head around to ride away.
Mr. Tilsdale ain't gonna like this very much, Nate.
Good. Hope he chokes on it.
Nate turned to the others.
Okay, boys. Round them up, move them out.
You want us just to take the ones with your brand on them, or you want us to get the calves, too?
Take everything with my brand on it and everything without any brand on it and scatter the rest all over the range.
Well, we're gonna get a lot of calves that belong to Tilsdale, then.
Maybe it'll teach him not to mess with the other small ranches around here. Especially ones that belong to the Northern Wyoming Farmers and Stock Growers Association.
You're a man after my own heart, Nate. Tough as nails and hard as steel.
Only way to be and still survive out here, George.
Early the next morning, Nate was having coffee and pan dulch in his cabin with an old friend, Ross Gilbertson.
Well, how do you feel about the men electing you president of the Northern Wyoming Farmers and Stock Growers Association the other night, Nate?
Well, other than the fact that it's kind of like hanging a bullseye on my shirt, I guess it's all right.
You don't really think the other Cattlemen's Association will try and do anything against you, do you?
I think it's only a matter of time, Ross. The big ranchers can't allow us little ranchers and independents to organize. Otherwise, they won't have any power over the cattle business in Wyoming.
What do you mean?
Well, for instance, if enough of us gather together, we can get the legislature to repeal the Maverick Law, and that's where the WSGA gets the money to finance their stock detectives and hire the bounty hunters to shoot down innocent ranchers.
As Nate slapped at his thigh, he realized his pistol was hanging on a post next to the wall behind his head. He was unarmed. 3 men wearing bandanas over their faces stormed into the room, pistols in their hands.
Put them up!
Nate and Gilbertson raised their hands.
What do you men want here? I don't have no money nor valuables for you to rob.
We ain't robbers, champion. We came to drill you through and through for all the rustling you've been doing of the association's stock.
Nate slowly nodded, staring at what he could see of the men's faces over their kerchiefs. He saw one of the men had a crooked scar over his right eye, running through his eyebrow, and he knew that was Joe Elliott, a stock detective for the association.
I ain't no rustler, and you boys know it.
One of the men with Elliott turned to the detective.
What about this other fella? They didn't say nothing about killing anybody else.
Shut up, you idiot! Who might you be, mister? You a rustler like your friend here?
My name is Ross Gilbertson, and neither one of us is rustlers.
Are you a rancher?
No, I'm not. I own a general store over in Buffalo. Me and Nate been friends since we was pups.
Well, you're gonna die with him anyway.
Hey, just a minute. We ain't got no call to be killing innocent shopkeepers.
While Elliot was distracted, Nate extended his hands back over his head toward the post holding his holster and Colt. When Elliot turned his eyes to the other man, Nate grabbed his pistol and drew and cocked in one fluid motion. The other two intruders dove through a door into another room in the cabin. Gilbertson dove to the floor while Nate flipped the table over and the two friends got behind it, using it as a partial cover. Elliot stuck his head around the door. Nate didn't bother to duck, but instead took aim.
Oh, goddamn! I'm hit, Frank! I'm hit!
Nate's slug hit Elliot in the forehead, burning a shallow furrow across his scalp and piercing his hat.
Come on! Let's get out of here!
While Nate hid behind the table, the two men scrambled on hands and knees into the front room, gathered up their wounded friend, and ran out the front door. Nate bounded up and ran out the side door. He saw Elliot grab at his shoulder as if one of the shots had hit home, but he couldn't be certain just how bad the man had been wounded.
Whew. Holy Mother Mary of Christ! That was a close call, Nate!
It was.
You think that was men from the WSGA come to kill you?
I know it was, Ross. The man doing most of the talking was Joe Elliott, one of the men the association hired as so-called stock detectives. Hired killers is more like it.
What about the other two?
I don't know. I didn't recognize either one of them.
Cowardly bastards. Busting in on a man's house, wearing masks like common stage robbers. They ought to be hanged.
Yeah, they should. But you and I both know with the power of the WSGA behind them, there's slim chance anything will ever come of it.
What you gonna do now, Nate?
First off, I'm going into Buffalo and file a formal complaint with Sheriff Red Angus. He's pretty much on our side in this range war, but even his hands are tied, especially since we can't testify we saw any faces on the men.
Then what's gonna happen?
Then I'm gonna call for a roundup by our association. We're gonna start rounding up Mavericks on our own. We'll just see what the WSGA tries to do about it.
Smoke boarded the train and stuffed his valise under his seat. Train pulled out of Big Rock, heading north, straight into the face of a chilly wind blowing southward from the Arctic regions of Canada. Smoke pulled his coat tight. The railroad passenger cars were unheated, and the temperature in the drafty coach was barely above freezing. As ice crystals formed on the window and wind-driven sleet and snow pounded the glass, he was grateful he wasn't trying to make the trip on horseback. Smoke took out a small map and used his finger to trace his path to where he'd heard the Nez Perce had been sighted. It was about 125 miles straight north from Big Rock to Casper, Wyoming, and then another 80 miles or so up to Buffalo, where the engines were supposed to be camped. His trip would take him through Boulder, cut back south to Denver, then head north to Greeley. From there, it was a short hop to Cheyenne and then Laramie. From Laramie, the Union Pacific ran north to Medicine Bow and finally Casper, where he would change trains for a ride up into the Bighorn Mountains and Buffalo on a spur line. He knew he was traveling in the worst of the winter weather, and he expected many delays as tracks would have to be cleared of snow drifts at times, especially in the higher elevations of the many mountain passes they were to traverse. He wondered briefly if he was, as Sally had hinted, being foolish to head north at this time of year. Sally, an ex-school teacher, was exceptionally smart, and Smokey found she was not often wrong about such things. No matter. He loved Sally deeply and had never regretted giving up his traveling ways to marry her and settle down. But lately, he'd been feeling hemmed in by civilization, crushed by the weight of humanity all around him. Since his teen years, when he had lived with Preacher, Smoke had loved the high lonesome of the mountains. He was more used to going months without seeing another human being than being in their company on a daily basis. Smoke pulled his hat down over his face, stuck his hands in his coat pockets, and settled back for a nap as the iron horse pulled him through the blizzards toward a much-needed adventure in the mountains. The trip was uneventful until he reached Denver, where the conductor announced there would be a layover due to the heaviness of the snowfall. The passengers were told the train would leave at dawn, with a snowplow engine preceding them through the mountain passes north of the town. Smoke took his valise and walked two blocks down the main street to check into the Alhambra Hotel. He had need of a hot bath to get the cinders and ash from the engine off his clothes and out of his hair and skin after traveling all day. Once in his room, Smoke unpacked fresh clothes and took them, his money belt holding $2,000 in greenbacks, and his Colt Navy pistol with him to the room where the hotel had several tubs set up and an attendant keeping water heated on a wood-burning stove. Smoke set his clothes, gun, and the money belt on a chair next to the tub and eased down into the steaming soapy water. Smoke smiled as he thought how ironic it was that he could ride horseback for days at a time and never get stiff or sore. But 12 hours in a rocking and rolling passenger car, and he felt like someone had beaten the hell out of him with axe handles. Smoke realized with a start that he could hear the jangle of spurs on boots. Men coming for a bath seldom wore their spurs. He sat up a little in the tub and reached over to pick up his Colt and slip it under the suds, resting it on his knees just above the water while he waited. Seconds later, three rough-looking men stepped into the room. They were all wearing trail clothes that looked and smelled as if they hadn't been washed for weeks.
Come in, gentlemen. The water is hot and soapy, and just right to take that stink of the trail off you.
The man in the middle, who seemed to be the leader of the trio, narrowed his eyes and glared at Smoke. He took a few steps forward and leaned over to pick through Smoke's clothes, cutting his eyes at his friends when he fingered the money belt.
We say, boys, look what we got here. A bunch of fancy city duds and a big old thick money belt.
Maybe you ought to ask real polite-like if the gent's soaking over there minds you pawing through his stuff, Carl.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Johnny. Say, mister, you don't have any objection to my looking at your clothes, do you?
As a matter of fact, I do mind. Your hands are filthy and you stink. Please, put my things down and leave the room.
Uh-huh. And what if I don't?
Then I'll just have to get out of my nice hot bath and make you. And I promise, you won't like that one bit.
Carl, too damn dumb to notice the warning signs, ignored Smoke and opened the belt, his eyes widening at the sight of the thick stacks of bills lying inside.
Jesus! Johnny, Sam, come here and take a look at what this dude's carrying.
As the two men rushed over, the attendant tried to sneak out the door behind him. Carl drew his pistol and pointed it at the young man.
Hold on there, Ace. You ain't going anywhere. Just stay put where you are.
Johnny reached down and fingered the greenbacks, his mouth hanging open in wonderment.
Jeez, Carl. I ain't never seen so much money in one place at a time.
Gentlemen, I worked hard for that stake. Now, do you really think I'm going to sit here and let pond scum like you take it from me?
Carl stepped back, still holding the belt in one hand and his pistol in the other.
Well, Mr. City Dude, I don't see you have much choice in the matter. I think we'll just tie you and the boy up, head on out of town. By the time somebody finds you, we'll be long gone.
I want you to think on it real hard, Carl. Is that money worth dying for? Because I'm giving you one last chance to put it down and walk out of here. Otherwise, I'll see that you're carried out on a board.
Well, maybe I won't tie you up after all, Pilgrim. Maybe I'll just drill you instead.
Boy, you can see they just don't give me any option.
The attendant just stood there, his hands over his mouth and his eyes wide and tearing from the acrid gun smoke in the room. He stared at the dead men for a moment. Then he looked at Smoke, his face paling as if he might faint. Smoke carefully wiped his pistol on a towel before placing it gently on his clothes. Then he lay back in the water.
Boy, open that window over there and let some of the smoke out of the room. Then get me some more hot water. All this jawing has let my bath cool down.
As the smoke whirled out of the open window and the room began to clear, a man wearing a sheriff's star on his vest came running into the room, his gun in his hand.
What the hell's going on in here?
The sheriff glared at Smoke, turning his pistol to point at him.
Are you responsible for this, mister?
Smoke opened his eyes and sat up a little to look over the edge of the tub, as if noticing the dead bodies for the first time.
No, Sheriff, those men are. They started the dance, and I just reminded them someone had to pay the band. And as you can see, it ended up being them.
The sheriff walked over to stand before Smoke, his pistol still pointing at his chest.
What's your name, mister?
Smoke. Smoke Jensen.
The Smoke Jensen?
I wasn't aware there was more than one. And Sheriff, would you mind pointing that hog leg away? I get a mite nervous when someone aims a gun at me.
Yes, sir, Mr. Jensen.
The sheriff looked over his shoulder at his deputy.
Dewey! Get somebody in here to clean up this mess so Mr. Jensen can finish having his bath.
Dewey glanced at Smoke, his mouth open, his eyes wide, and his knuckles white where they gripped his shotgun.
Dewey, damn it, get a move on!
Sheriff Thomas turned back to Smoke and spread his arms wide.
I'm sorry about all this, Mr. Jensen. Every winter, we get a bunch of white trash coming to this town when the blizzards blow. It's hard to keep a handle on things when the town's full like this.
No problem, Sheriff Thomas.
Mr. Jensen, are you planning on staying in town long?
Just long enough to get a steak in the dining room and grab a few hours shut-eye until the train to Wyoming pulls out in the morning, Sheriff. I'd appreciate it if you'd keep the fact that I'm here quiet until then. Otherwise, you're liable to have more bodies to clean up.
The sheriff looked to the attendant.
Jeremiah! Go tell the cook to get Mr. Jensen's steak ready so he don't have to wait in the dining room too long.
Yeah, and tell him to cook it just long enough so it doesn't crawl off the plate, and it'll be just fine.
The sheriff's eyes widened at the sight of Smoke's body. He stood 6'2" tall, with broad shoulders and huge, heavily muscled arms. His waist was lean, and his ash-blonde hair was cut short and neat. The sheriff couldn't help but notice the many scars covering Smoke's skin, mementos of hundreds of fights with guns, knives, and fists.
You sure look like you've been to the river and back again, Mr. Jensen.
Just one of the many prices of fame, sure. Just one.
Smoke pulled on his pants.
Are there any Indians in town?
In Denver? There's dozens, especially in the winter.
Would you do me a favor, Sheriff Thomas? Would you ask around and see if any of them know anything about a small tribe of Nez Perce? Supposed to be camping up near Buffalo in northern Wyoming.
Sure thing. Jeremiah, after you're done talking to the cook about Mr. Jensen's steak, head on over to the cantina at the other end of town and do what Mr. Jensen asks. If any of them braves or breeds knows anything, bring them on back to the hotel. You'll have to stay with them, or they won't let him in to talk to him.
Mighty obliged, Sheriff.
Least I can do, Mr. Jensen, after you helped clean some of the trash out of my town for me.